almost rolling. Okay, slow start as always. Apple products kicking ass. Episode 210 of the Paleo Solution Podcast in the house is Greg Everett. Greg, what's going on, man?
Not much. Just got back from the American Open in freezing cold Dallas.
Dude, I thought Dallas was warm.
On Monday.
Didn't they order up like an ice storm for you guys while you were there?
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty fun. A lot of canceled flights.
Sweet. Oh, that's right. I remember seeing like China was stuck there for like six extra days or something trying to get out. So
I think it was one, but it feels like six.
Exactly. So and Catalyst took second place at the Open?
Yeah, our women's team took silver medal
for
the second year in a row. So everybody did a great job.
Nice. Right on.
I'm happy to be back home in California where cold is like 40 degrees.
Yeah, cold in Reno last night was 0 degrees Fahrenheit, like minus 22 Celsius. So
fudge that.
Yep. But we have snow. So
yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's a bonus. But
so it looks nice from inside.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't see the burning gravel currently. So yes. Dr. Kirk Parsley's favorite line. How does gravel burn from early in the day? So let's see here. Bang through some podcast sponsors, and we'll get this bad mamba-jamba going. FrontDeskHQ.com. FrontDesk is your mobile-based solution for service-based businesses, CrossFit, dog walking, yoga-ing, Pilates-ing, you know, collect money, schedule folks. Don't suck as a business owner, basically, is where this thing plays out. So check out FrontDeskHQ.com if you you want to, you know, make some money and succeed in your service-based business. WellFoodCo.com.
Who wants to do that?
Yeah. WellFoodCo, a fantastic resource for grass-fed jerky. We have all kinds of cool stuff rolling out with WellFoodCo. Have some gluten-free, large caloric density MRE replacements coming out. So, which that's kind of funny. So it's meals ready to eat. It's not like a meal replacement deal, so it's not overly redundant. But check out WellFoodCo. MassaMeats.com. Just got to hang out with Dwayne Massa this last weekend at the Savory Institute. Super cool dude. Awesome folks. They are who I get my grass-fed meat from. They ship anywhere in the lower 48 and are fantastic folks. And then finally, the Performance Menu, Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence. You've got two different levels of buy-in. $30 a year for all the current issues available in a plethora of different formats. $100 a year buy-in gives you all the back issues plus 15% off the Catalyst Athletic Store. What else? What else?
That's pretty much it.
And as always, cooking with Scotty. Scotty Hagness, always a good, damn good
recipe.
He
has been doing recipes every single month for the Performance Menu Journal for 9 years. I honestly don't understand how that's even possible. Like every month, I'm sure he's going to email and be like, dude, I don't have any more recipes. I'm done. This is stupid. And he just keeps pumping them out.
Well, he lives in a mecca of food. He's around Portland.
He's the silent kitchen murderer, man. He just like sneaks around and makes cool recipes and sends them to us. So,
and the only way you're going to get that stuff is by subscribing to the Performance Menu. So get off your duff and do it. Okay.
There you go. All right. Okay, let's see here.
This is a fun podcast. Squatchy, Squatchy does a great job, but this one looks particularly interesting. There's some goodies in here.
I haven't even looked at it, I'll be honest.
Perfect.
Okay, Kevin says, hey dudes, I am lucky enough to work for one of these newfangled tech companies that feeds me 3 meals a day. I love it, and I'm not quitting my cushy job anytime soon. It's often fairly easy to find paleo grub. However, many of the meat dishes are cooked using canola oil. I've spoken with the chefs about this, and unfortunately they're under the impression that canola oil is a healthy cooking fat, conventional wisdom and all, so it's probably not changing anytime soon. Anywho, my options for avoiding canola in my free meals are A, avoiding all meat, B, bringing my own chow from home, or C, just sucking it up and eating the food. C actually is not an option for avoiding canola in your free meals, just to clarify. But counteracting accordingly elsewhere. Hoping for your advice on option C. I know you've backed down from your fish oil recommendation, but maybe I should supplement more aggressively to make sure my ratios remain optimal. Obviously, trying to keep my at-home food as low in omega-6s as possible, but I do eat at least 1 to 2 meals a day at work. Thanks for the podcast. You guys are truly saving lives.
You know, I think that the place where you could get yourself into deep water with stuff like canola oil and soybean oil and whatnot is actually more on the salad dressing side. Because when you're cooking meat, I mean, you typically don't use a ton of cooking oil. Half of it stays in the pan or on the grill. And so I really wouldn't be super spun out about this. Like, this is one of those things that I think people go a little bit overboard, particularly when they're new to paleo and they're trying to really follow all the guidelines. I mean, if you're generally eating gluten-free, you're getting good carbs, making sure your vitamin D is good, supplementing a little bit of extra fish oil. And to your point, I think still that like 2 to 4, 2 to 5 grams of fish oil, kind of varying it from day to day, you should be fine with that. And just given the ease of, you know, getting some decent grub at work and not needing to sweat cooking it and all that, I would just go for that option, man. And I really wouldn't worry about a little bit of canola oil in your chow. And something you might do if you want to is just, you know, grab one of the big Costco cans of like that Nutiva coconut oil that's really tasty and delicious and all that. And the fat, it's in basically like a food service size container. Just buy that and throw it to the chef and just be like, hey, dude or dudette, you know, if you want to try giving this a shot, see how you like the flavor. And then if it's ever convenient for you when I'm asking for something, just throw some coconut oil in there for it. And possibly what that may get you is a lot of spit and eyebrows in your food, but
it's probably in there already.
Yeah, anyway. It's probably in there already because of the pest that you've been already. But that's just a way to do it. But, you know, by and large, I wouldn't worry about the bit of canola oil that you're going to get from cooking meat.
So have you seen that movie, This Is the End, yet?
I did, and it's amazing.
That opening scene about gluten is like the funniest thing I've ever heard.
It's totally
gluten amazing. Is just kind of like a vague term for bad stuff. You know, like calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten. Oh, shit. Okay. So, does this make it okay to pee in the pool? Patrick says, hey, Rob, just wanted to get your thoughts on this far-out theory championed by Elaine Morgan. And judging by the title of in the link here, Elaine Morgan says we evolved from aquatic apes. could this be an explanation why the archaeological community has such a gap between our arboreal ancestors and us? Could it be possible that our direct lineage spent most of their time in areas that are not well suited for fossil formation? Part of me wants to write this theory off as crazy, but a part of me wants to believe it. They thought Alfred Wegener was crazy talking about continents moving around the planet. What do you think?
You know, it's funny. So I was just at the Savory Institute gig in Chico, and I'm actually working on a blog post about that. It was totally amazing, life-altering deal. Alan Savory, I want him to be like my dad or uncle or something. The guy is totally amazing. But we had dinner, and we had a couple of glasses of wine in us, and we got talking about human evolution and all that. And Alan is actually a champion of the aquatic ape theory. And this thing is kind of come and gone. It was kind of hot and heavy for a while, and then not so much. But you know, there are some really interesting features to it, and one of them is that there is a paucity of fossil records at these really kind of key developmental points. And one of the theories with that is that you don't really leave a lot of fossils right at that tidal interface because of all the wave action, and also you can have a seafloor changes or basically sea level changes. So where fossils were being laid down at one point, you know, maybe 200 or 300 feet below water or, you know, whatever. So it today, so it would make the fossils difficult to find. Lauren Cordain was actually working on a paper, and I'm not sure where this went, but he was looking at encephalization of hominids and how much EPA DHA goes into forming the brain. How much gut volume we've lost, the need for dense, nutrient-rich foods to make this whole thing happen. And he was doing modeling based off of getting the monounsaturated fats out of bone marrow plus the contents of skull casing, basically brains. And he was modeling that, and he was also modeling what one would typically find at the tide pool interface. And the last that I talked to him about it was that both of these models were really rather close. That, you know, just from like the expensive tissue hypothesis, increasing encephalization, increasing brain size, decreasing gut size, both of these things actually worked pretty well. Like you got calorie-rich, omega-3-rich foods from both sources. And so you had a little bit of an argument both kind of on both sides. Alan and I were talking about the fact that if these apes were spending a significant amount of time in the water, maybe that actually led to easier bipedalism because you had a little bit of a buoyancy kind of gig. And so, you know, it would lend itself more for kind of an upright bipedal kind of situation. Also, an interesting thing is that humans carry a lot more body fat, particularly subcutaneous body fat. And one of the interesting adaptations, and we're actually going to talk about swimming here in a little bit, ironically, but cold water immersion tends to stimulate the deposition of fat, particularly below the skin, as an insulating factor. And so, you know, there's some interesting stuff with that. But then there's also some observations that humans sweat, and we sweat really efficiently. And the fact that, you know, as we developed an upright stance, then if we're out traipsing across the savanna, then we absorb less heat. You know, so there's a lot of different theories out there, but the aquatic ape thing is kind of an interesting. Who knows? You know, and I think that it's, we have enough evidence pointing in a couple of different directions to maybe not write everything off. I thought maybe about 2 years ago that a big chunk of the anthropology community, archaeology community, had said, okay, the aquatic ape theory is kaput, you know, for the following reasons. But then, as with most of science, they tend to replay the tape on that pretty frequently. So it's interesting for sure.
Well, how do you like that?
Who'd have thunked it?
And this this thread that Squatchy has constructed here is incredible.
The continuity because is absolutely amazing.
I just looked at the next two questions, and it's amazing, Squatchy. You are an artist.
That is why Squatchy runs this operation, and I'm merely along for the ride. So
yeah, when I was choosing questions, I pretty much just looked at the inbox with like 800 emails and chose at random. All right. Frank says, hey, Rob, my email concerns swimming, specifically if it falls under chronic cardio. I started swimming for body composition and have come to enjoy it. I do it 2 days a week for about 30 to 45 minutes. The details of the workout are I usually swim some laps at a high intensity, then in between I do some laps at a lower intensity and great volume. I know that you usually warn against cardio, but I feel swimming is a separate matter. It is a full body exercise that requires the use of muscles as well as having some stamina. Thanks. NorCal margaritas are the shit.
Indeed they are. Indeed they are. You know, as always with all this stuff, you know, it's kind of the poisons in the dose. And I think what you're describing here, a couple of days a week, 30 to 45 minutes of a mixed activity level, I think that's fantastic. I really think that what we see, where we see problems when people are spending like 6 hours a day on a bicycle or you know, they're running into injury, they're bicycling into injury, they're swimming into injury. We had a client who was just a fantastic woman, but she did all kinds of triathlons, and she considered swimming a stretch. Each time she would come into the gym and we'd start working with her, she, you know, the movement of putting her hand overhead to do a swimming movement, she's like, yeah, I just get a really good stretch from that. And I'm just like, yeah, that means you are so fucking almost crippled in your thoracic, you know, mobility that it almost could make me cry. So that's the you know, when we start getting orthopedic issues from the activity and you know, if you, there's a great TED talk from I think a cardiothoracic surgeon who used to be a big time marathoner, ultra endurance runner, and he ran some blood work on himself and he found elevated troponin levels that were, troponin being a protein that's released from the heart when we have a heart attack, but they actually saw elevated troponin levels similar to heart attack levels from just a really long duration, high intensity endurance activity. And it's a different type of damage to the heart, but it's still damage to the heart. So, and again, there's this other piece to the story that if you just absolutely love that stuff and you're like, well, fuck it, if it's going to take 7 years off my life, at least I'm happy, then God love you for that. That's fine. But I think that a lot of people do way more cardio, way more physical activity than what really is actually good for them in the misguided assumption that more is better, and that if they took a day off and foam rolled and stretched and, you know, watch some Archer on FX or something like that, that they would somehow turn to a blob in one day. And that's just not really the case.
True. Okay.
profound input.
Oh, boy. Okay, seaweed and MSG. Everybody seeing the theme here? Michael says, Rob and Greg, good podcast. That's about the most effusive praise we've ever gotten right there.
True.
Good podcast, period. It's not great. It's not fantastic. He doesn't love it. It's just pretty. It's okay.
But it's not so-so. I mean, it's good. It's good.
Yeah, okay. I always hear that MSG is to be avoided, but wasn't glutamic acid first discovered in seaweed? Seaweed is supposed to be good for me, but is it a neurotoxin, or are the levels of glutamic acid inconsequential? And what's your opinion on this umami taste? Thanks.
Oh, man. The umami taste is amazing.
Is that savory?
It's savory, yeah. Yeah. I've always been a little bit suspicious of the glutamic acid deal. Just looking at glutamate, the way that you can get it dietarily, and I've just never really been able to wrap my head around how, you know, monosodium glutamate, MSG was at all problematic. And when I lived with the Cambodian family, we ate the stuff by the truckload full. I mean, they had 5-pound bags of it, and we used it in the soup base and all that all the time. So I know it, when I've looked around in the research, I just haven't found stuff that's really convincing to me that it's a legitimate neurotoxin. Glutamic acid is a neurotransmitter. There are ways of upregulating glutamic acid activity in the brain such that it could become a neurotoxin, but I don't really see it coming from like the dietary source in this way. And I think that a lot of... I think that we could chalk a lot of this stuff up to other food reactions, particularly gluten. And, you know, a lot of the foods where you would see a high glutamic acid content, like a high MSG content, either from supplemental or you know, like the seaweed base, you're also getting things like soybeans, and the most soy sauce is brewed with wheat. So I think that a lot of what we're seeing are other problems that kind of get hung on MSG. I am not really, I guess I'm not an MSG believer, or, you know, whatever the, what's the, you know, what's the 9/11, you know, like the 9/11 truther. I'm not an MSG truther, put it that way. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't really seen all that much compelling about it. People will absolutely lose their minds over the topic. Let's say that there is some untoward effects from this stuff for certain people, which is clearly within the realm of possibility. I would still put that on an order of issues pretty far down the list. But, you know, we do know that some seaweeds have some large polysaccharides, which can be problematic from like a gut health standpoint with the whole FODMAPs deal. But even that, I'm getting super continually more confused on. I've been reading a bunch of the stuff on resistant starch and the need for more resistant starch to puff up colonic bacterial content. And I the more time goes on, the less I feel like I know. So there you go.
Yeah, I have that same feeling. But I didn't start at such a high level as you, so it's not as devastating.
Well, you know, I think that most of mine, though, is just due to memory loss, so...
Yeah.
And well, inability to think.
Yeah. I have CRS also, so... Okay. Paleo Business Investing. Dan says, hi, guys. Thanks for all the hard work on the podcast and elsewhere. I've covered episodes from 160-ish onward and have yet to hear a question of this flavor. Is it an umami flavor? With all the momentum the paleo movement has acquired recently, it seems inevitable that the expansion will continue and gain popularity. That being said, how can someone take advantage of the exponential future trajectory of growth from a business standpoint? That is totally unpaleo, what you just said. I'd like to invest something like stocks, something like stocks in a grass-fed farm, slow food, but don't have enough money to be able to be an investor in a private company. What are some options that will both A, allow me to get a potential decent return, and B, help finance this movement further? Perhaps some put some options on Monsanto or General Mills are the best bet at this point. Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. That could be the best option.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. So the reason why I haven't talked a lot about this stuff is when I start talking about... It's funny. I can sneak in a few things. Like the Monsanto piece is actually kind of a... an interesting deal. I can use a Monsanto article, and because it just has Monsanto in it, I can talk about healthcare. I can talk about markets. I can talk about, you know, the problems with third-party payer health insurance stuff and all that sort of jive. And because it just has Monsanto in there, I'm okay, because everybody hates Monsanto, and then we're cool, and we, you know, we can fly in whatever type of market-based stuff that we want. But if I actually just try to talk about this in a general setting, then people fucking lose their minds, and it's, it's politics, it's this, it's that. And so I don't talk a lot about that on here. I remember I still, every once in a while, so when we started the Controversial Truth podcast, I did a blog post saying, hey guys, I'm going to be talking about politics stuff over here to keep this stuff separated. Here we go. And I had all kinds of angry fucking people crawling up my ass because I was going to go do something on my own time that I believe in, and completely separating it from them, and or doing my damnedest to do so. And every once in a while, I still get a comment on that, and it's like, Rob, you're a prick. So there you go. So yeah, that's why I don't talk a ton about it on here. Although I'm reaching a point of can't give a fuck about it anymore, particularly after this Alan Savory gig, because kind of long and short of that is that we've been right about all of this shit, the sustainability, the markets, all of it, and more that'll come out over time. So I'm probably going to be less and less prone to editing my commentary. So anyway, enough of that shit. So I think that there are some huge opportunities out there for things like this. There's actually an outfit called Grasslands LLC, and Chris Martinson mentioned them on his podcast. What these folks do is they are going in and buying up some smartly located farmlands. And what they do, it's almost like a hedge fund where people can invest money in Grasslands LLC. Grasslands LLC is then able to aggregate this money, go out, buy tracts of land, hire farmers to work that land. And what they typically do is they take conventional farmland and then move it towards organic. And there's all kinds of benefits with regards to a price point with the organic story and all that jive. And I've got some stuff that I'm working on between the City Zero scene and then also the work that we're doing with the Savory Institute, that I think that we could do something very similar where we create a hedge fund. The deal with the Grasslands LLC is you still need a pretty good chunk of money to be able to buy into this thing. And I forget what it is, like a 20 grand or 60 grand minimum investment, or maybe it's 100 grand. I forget. But that, you know, it ends up screening a whole lot of people out of that process. But I think that we could easily do something similar within the paleo movement and buy up actually marginal lands and use the Savory model to start converting that marginal land back into highly productive land. You'd run a variety of different animals on the land in this same kind of holistic management format that the Savory Institute is becoming more and more famous for. You would train people to be farmers on the land, and maybe they're an employee, or maybe they have some opportunity to get like some options in this business at some point. But I think there's lots of opportunities with stuff like that. So the only thing that I would say that is 100% solid on the books right now is this Grasslands LLC. They're very interesting. They have a cool business model, but I've definitely got some ideas for some stuff in the future.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. And now we're off the reservation completely talking about sperm.
Gotta mix it up.
Healthy sperm equals healthy baby. Grace says, Rob, I'm an absolute convert. I've forsaken my evil ways and joined the paleo community. Oh, God, Grace. This is why people freak out about paleo and stuff. Don't get weird. I've been eating paleo for 5 months now, and I've never felt better. My question is in regard to a discussion my husband and I have been having about our future babies. We wanted to start having kids in a few years, and I'm determined to have the healthiest babies ever. Healthiest babies ever. We know that my diet will have a huge impact on our growing fetus, but having a debate on how his diet will impact his sperm's contribution to the pregnancy. A little background on him. He's 27, lean, and fit. He's in the military, about to go to Special Forces selection in a few days, so he has little say in his diet most of the time. He goes through periods of time where he's eating MREs for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which I'm pretty sure we can all agree is not optimal baby-making material. During the time he is home, he can eat however he likes, typically paleo because I do all the grocery shopping. Do you think it would make a difference in the health of our child if we conceive after he has had some time to eat the way humans were meant to eat? If you have any insight that can help us have the healthiest children in the whole world, I will be eternally grateful.
Wowzers. Possibly, Grace, your heart's in the right place. Possibly micromanaging things a little bit, but we'll talk about this a little bit more.
What about the stress of that training? Like, I'm just thinking about that book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers.
Right. And, you know, that's actually maybe 4 days ago, there was a piece that came out talking about different epigenetic features of the male's environment that can alter the genetics and the epigenetics of the fetus. And it's really interesting. And there's a lot more that can go into altering a beneficial gene expression than what we thought, and particularly from the father's side. And so I'll try to dig up a link to that. But it's interesting. Like, this thing came up maybe 4 days ago. And Grace, if you float around Facebook at all, you'll probably find this thing linked. But it's basically males... father's health influences baby's health is kind of the search term tagline that would track that down for you. The biggies that they found, though, were actually different pharmaceuticals that folks were taking. And I forget exactly what were the baddies, but, you know, sedentism was actually a bigger issue than, you know, they didn't really look at overtraining per se, and special operations training is probably about as gnarly training as you're ever going to find. So I, you know, that's tough, but sedentism is pretty bad. Bad diet was definitely influential. Some different pharmaceuticals were somewhat correlated with some different goings ons, but I just scanned the paper. I haven't given it a full read yet. So do some fishing around on that. But the bottom line is, it sounds like your husband is generally healthy, generally eats as well as he can. The MREs are clearly not, you know, super ideal, but I think that a big part to look at this is, so long as he's not showing metabolic derangement, then we're probably cool. Like, that would be a guess that I would make. And also, there's kind of a reality of just, you know, this is the life that he's chosen to live, and so you've got to kind of make the best of it that you can, and I wouldn't worry too much beyond that.
All right.
And making babies are fun, more or less. So, you know, until they arrive, and then the last good night of sleep you ever have is the day before your first child arrives, pretty much. So,
yes. All right. Let's see here. I'm looking ahead, and I'm trying to see if this word is not what it's supposed to be. All right. Male infertility and freaking out. Weldon says, Weldon, that's like the coolest name we've had on the podcast. Thank you so much for all you do. I've lost roughly 40 pounds since starting ketogenic paleo without training. I've become very strict, and I've been eating grass-fed beef, pastured pork, chicken, and a ton of eggs. I supplement with magnesium, vitamin D3, and ZMA. Prior to going paleo, my wife and I have been trying to get pregnant for 3 years. I saw a urologist and found that I have a super low sperm count. I had, this is not right, varicocele?
Yeah.
Surgery?
Yeah.
On my testicles to see if the temp change would increase the count, and below are some of my numbers. FSH 19.9. Oh, I'm not going to read all these. It'll be in the notes. Blah, blah, blah. 36-year-old man who weighs 200 pounds and have body fat of roughly 21%. My urologist said my FSH and LH are very high, but has no idea how to change any of these numbers for the better. Also forgot my sperm count is below 1 million. How could I go about changing things if unable to become fertile? How could I begin to lean out?
Man, this one might be one that we revive the next time we have Doc Parsley on, because the testosterone level that he gives, 242, is low. FSH is high. Luteinizing hormone is high. So you would expect, you know, to me, looking at this, there's some sort of feedback that's not occurring. Like the brain is trying to turn the good old boys on, and they're just not producing. They're not really producing testosterone. It looks like they're also not producing sperm. So I would want to know, like, an estrogen, estradiol number. And then honestly, like, beyond that, it starts getting super murky for me. And I would need to track down someone like Doc Parsley to make better sense of what's going on with this. Clearly, there's some attempt. This is, to me, this is a little bit like when you see low thyroid but very high thyroid stimulating hormone. Like the, you know, in that case, the thyroid, the brain is trying to get adequate levels of thyroid, and then you have to start looking at like, what's T4, T3? Do we have high reverse T3 and stuff like that? This looks on the surface similar to that. Like the brain is trying to get the elevated testosterone levels, you know, normal testosterone levels, but they're just, it's not happening. And who knows why? And again, this is where looking at cortisol levels, thyroid levels, like all these other factors would probably be very helpful to at least get a big picture perspective on this and have something to go on. I wish I had more to tell you. I'll put this in the Doc Parsley file for when we have him on again. He's going to be on in a couple of weeks, and we can revisit this and see what he's got on this. But I suspect that we would need some more diagnostic blood work. We would definitely want to look at cortisol, ASI test for cortisol. We'd want to know estrogen, estradiol. We'd want to know a full thyroid panel at the minimum, just to kind of tick all that stuff off and know that we've done some due diligence on the HPTA axis, because that can be so influential on testosterone production.
Yeah, all that's probably true, but not to make too much light of the situation, but if you want to lean out and you're trying to get pregnant with a low sperm count, you just have to have sex all the time, because then you're exercising and you're increasing the probability of knocking your wife up.
It's multitasking, or like one of my early articles for the performance menu, multidimensionality training.
Yes. Oh, boy. Okay, bone health and starvation. Oh, I see what he did here. Get it? We're talking about sperm count, and the next one is bone health.
Bing!
Shoot. Amanda says, hey, Rob, I'm a 21-year-old female. Say no more. He's already interested. Have been a competitive athlete since a young age, equestrian, snow sports, swimming, etc.
Do tell.
And last year made the decision to compete in fitness modeling. God knows why. I have already been quite successful with paid photographic, but unfortunately the vanity and competitive nature of my 20-year-old brain took over. My coach starved me below 600 calories a day, and I'm a 6-foot female, and overtrained me, not uncommon, sadly. Since then, I have rebounded after a post-competition metabolism shutdown, and using paleo protocols repaired my metabolism, but despite this, I have suffered more serious bone injuries since this time than ever before. Osteochondral fissure in my patella from box jumping at CrossFit, and now a fractured fibula from simply sitting on my leg at an odd angle. Obviously, my bone health is not great right now. What do you suggest to get this back? I used to be so resilient pre-starvation diet. Your help is so massively appreciated.
Holy fudge, man.
Don't do box jumps and don't sit down.
Yeah, never sit down. gosh, you know, this again, you're going to have to, in my opinion, you would probably want to get in and make sure what your estrogen levels are. Estrogen, estradiol is going to be so important for your bone mineral metabolism. Vitamin D level, clearly we need to make sure that you're getting enough basic calories, that you're getting vitamin D, magnesium, calcium out of the diet. Doing some bone broth would probably be a good idea in this case. But I would want to see a little bit of blood work to just kind of see what is happening on the endocrine side. Testosterone, estrogen, estradiol, like the standard kind of fertility hormone makeup, and vitamin D. And, you know, I would want to know that just as a baseline to make sure that there's not something seriously wrong there. And then from that point, it's just going to take some time to undo this and to just quit the fitness modeling stuff. I love looking at those photos on Facebook, but damn, it's rough on folks. So.
Yeah, and in all honesty, I know I said it jokingly, but quit doing box jumps and stuff like that for a while.
Yeah. Worry
less about bouncing around like a lab monkey in the CrossFit gym and do some legitimate load-bearing resistance work. Do some basic strength work and at least get that mechanical side of the bone density equation taken care of before you start doing all this, these ballistic things or any kind of plyometric stuff.
Yeah, because I mean, under the best of circumstances, the volume that a lot of gyms produce is just ridiculous. Like, there's no thought about progression. There's no thought about ramp up. There's no thought about a minimum effective dose. It's just, you know, more. And so even if you hadn't had this effect on your bone mineral density, you could be at looking at a stress fracture anyway. The fibula break from crossing your legs is probably indicative that there's a little bit more going on, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. Last one. Father-daughter paleo. Bring your daughter to diet day. Chris says, Rob and Greg, thanks for everything you do. When my dad was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2011, I decided to get serious about my health. I discovered paleo through Rob's book, and when I'm sticking to it, I feel great and perform better than ever. Herein lies the challenge. I'm a new dad of an adopted 2-year-old from Ethiopia. Life is good. However, it's been tough providing her with the nutrition she needs to catch up in her growth after life in an orphanage. On the plus side, she loves avocados, sweet potatoes, turkey dogs, and bacon. She's used to white bread, powdered milk, and cereals. What's the best way to feed a picky, iron-deficient kid going through a growth spurt? Secondly, life as a dad is seriously cramping my workout time. Other than sneaking in the occasional 10 to 15 minute mobility or bodyweight workout, I've only got about 2 1-hour workout days a week. What's the best bang for my buck? My goal is general fitness. As the 42-year-old dad of a 2-year-old, I want to be around as long as possible.
Man, you know, with the kiddo, I think, you know, soups and stews, if the kid will go for that. Zoe really likes soups, and we can fit in a lot of, like, she's a good little eater. She's only found a couple of things that she just kind of refuses to eat. But I find that I can just get more in her in the form of, like, some pureed soups and liver. If you can figure out a way to make liver palatable for the kiddo, that'll help a ton. Like making a pate. That was a way that we were able to get Zoe to get some liver. And after she started doing the pate, then she started doing just like hunks of liver. So that was a good ramp up for her with that. And, you know, considering the background she's coming from, I mean, you just do the best you can. It's going to be far better than what she had previously. We've really, really liked the Nordic Naturals kids DHA fish oil. We use like a little syringe to give Zoe that stuff. And Zoe eats, like I said, she's a good eater, but there's only a few things that after I give it to her, she immediately is like, more, 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 and just says it again and again. And the fish oil is something that she, you know, she does the sign language. She puts the hands together, is like, more, 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 and she loves that stuff. So that seems like a good thing to go for with that. And then, you know, for the dad and cramped training time, man, I definitely feel for you on that. I basically lift like 2 days a week at this point. You know, I think doing something that looks kind of CrossFit-esque, but with a little bit of structure to it. And, you know, like one day you could do this in like a rotating block. And ironically, there's an early CrossFit journal that's a beginner's template to CrossFit that you could use that. And I really like it, but something that you could do is look at like a standard, say like a Helen workout or a running Fran workout or something. So basically a one day would be a squat, a vertical press, a vertical pull. Another day would be a deadlift, a horizontal press, a horizontal pull, and you mix a run into that. And it's your classic like 21-15-9 format or, you know, like 3 sets of 7 across the board each round. But you could do a run, do some of the strength work in a block, rest a minute, do a run, do the strength work in a block, rest a minute, and bang that stuff out. Then you're getting some metabolic conditioning, some cardio, and you're doing your strength work. And the thing that you would do with that is just start with the weights or the loading in a very conservative spot so that week by week you could increase the loading. And then, you know, you keep the run at about the same pace, or if you have a rower, you're in Alaska, so I don't know, maybe it's, you know, mushing or cross-country skiing. Sled dogging around or something. But I think that that's a really, you get some good strength work, you get some cardio, you do a quick warm-up, you bang this stuff out, you've got time for a cool-down and a stretch and some mobility work. And then in between that, you know, you've got a pull-up bar somewhere in the house, you've got some parallettes or a couple of chairs to, you know, next to a counter where you can put your feet on the counter and get some deficit push-ups or something like that. And you just generally do some volume wherever you can get it then. But then that way you've got a 2 day a week split where you're doing a squatting movement and a deadlifting movement, plus vertical press, vertical pull, and on a different day, horizontal press, horizontal pull, set it up so that you can progress it reasonably over time. Maybe after 6 or 8 weeks of that, you change the movements, and then it's a front squat and a Romanian deadlift or something. I don't know. But I think that you could get a lot of mileage out of that, and it's not going to totally beat you down. It would be reasonably fun, quite quick, very time efficient, and should give you some pretty good benefit.
Yeah. That's it.
Sweet. All right. Anything else? Anything else that folks must know before we wrap this jobber up?
Let's see here. No, I don't think so. Cool. I think they should still go buy American Weightlifting if they haven't done so already.
Absolutely. Why don't we throw an extra link to that in the show notes?
All right. Sweet. We can do that.
All right, man. Well, congrats on the American Open. Congrats on the movie. And we actually had some people complaining on Twitter that you and I had not done a podcast together in a while. So that was kind of good.
Yeah, that's a good sign.
I figured everybody was over it. So
yeah, figured they'd moved on already.
Yeah.
All right, one of them new fancy podcasts.
Newfangled.
With the video and the HDs and the hi-fis and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, we're lucky if this thing works and our fidelity sucks and we just try to make some decent content and call it good with that.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work, then we'll just quit doing it.
Yes.
All right, dude. All right, man. We'll talk to you soon.
See ya.
Bye, G.